Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and today we are executing a mission critical for anyone trying to navigate the currents of modern volatility.
We certainly are.
We are diving deep into a stack of sources that provide an exhaustive look at the world right now. The Wall Street Journal for Monday, December 29th, 2025.
And I'm Sam Astor. And Alex, the sources you've supplied are, they're not just reporting the news.
No.
They are documenting a world caught between this exponential technological growth on one side and some really grinding geopolitical friction on the other.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
So our goal today is to synthesize all this complex material for you, our listener, and provide a really comprehensive, detailed, and clear analysis of every major development.
Right. We want you to walk away not just knowing what happened, but really why it matters and maybe what comes next.
Absolutely.
It's a study in extremes, isn't it? On one hand, we see these soaring, almost dizzying valuations being placed on artificial intelligence infrastructure. And on the other, you see corporations simultaneously just slamming the brakes on hiring.
Right, creating this stagnation across, you know, traditional white-collar jobs.
And that turbulence is mirrored globally. You have trade routes getting longer because of security concerns, and these 80-year-old political alliances suddenly being treated like liabilities.
And what's so fascinating to me is the convergence of what seem like totally unrelated issues.
Like what?
We're going to track how AI is driving investment bubbles, while it's also, you know, redefining human health choices.
From chronic pain treatment to childhood vision, which is a wild connection.
It is. From new treatments for chronic pain to the surprising ways digital reliance is causing an epidemic of vision issues in children, we're going to connect all those threads for you.
Okay, let's unpack this and start exactly where the paper starts, with the underlying economic structure of the United States.
The story here is this new corporate playbook that's being drafted for 2026. And the message is, well, it's chillingly simple. The major employers are planning to either hold the line or cut staff. We're seeing a structural shift here, not just, you know, a cyclical one.
But why should we see this as any different from, say, a typical recessionary fear? I mean, companies always get cautious when interest rates are high or there's uncertainty.
Because this uncertainty is now overlaid with a powerful, and I mean demonstrable, labor substitution technology.
Artificial intelligence.
Exactly. AI. The core outlook is that companies believe AI can handle more work, which means they don't need to expand their human labor pool to meet their growth goals.
So forecasters are basically expecting zero hiring growth.
Near zero, yeah.
Okay.
Across the board. And the Yale School of Management survey really hammered this point home.
What did they find?
66% of the CEOs they polled plan to either fire people or just maintain their current team size in the coming year.
66%. So that's two out of every three major corporate leaders actively limiting human headcount.
That's right. And the reluctance of executives to talk about this publicly is, well, it's very telling.
You mean like Charlie Scharf at Wells Fargo?
Perfect example. His bank has spent the last few years trimming its workforce, and he expects AI's impact on staffing levels to be extremely significant.
He said that publicly.
He did. He essentially confirmed what every analyst already suspects, that executives are fully aware their future headcount is going to be lower, but they are terrified to say it out loud.
Fearing what? Public backlash? Internal anxiety?
Both. They don't want to spook their own workforce or the markets. But the fear is not hypothetical. It's tangible in the job market already.
Especially in those sectors that have driven the U.S. economy for so long.
Right. Data analytics, software development, marketing, consulting. These white-collar sectors are where the most immediate automation is happening. Job openings tracked by Indeed show these areas are just seizing up.
And we are seeing the direct consequence of this fear in how employees are behaving.
You're talking about the IBM numbers.
Exactly. Voluntary attrition at IBM, which is, you know, the traditional bellwether of the tech industry, has hit a 30-year low.
A 30-year low. What's the number?
It's dropped below 2%. Normally, it's closer to 7%.
Wow. That is a massive shift.
It is. People are clinging to their jobs because they see the doors of opportunity closing everywhere else.
And the moment employees stop moving between jobs, that need for backfill hiring just, it evaporates. It cements that low-hire environment.
So economists are wrestling with this contradiction. How can the economy keep reporting GDP growth while large employers are signaling this profound lack of confidence in the need for human labor?
It's a huge question. As one economic researcher put it, this low-hire, low-fire environment just cannot be sustained indefinitely alongside economic expansion.
Something's got to give.
Something has to shift. Either growth has to falter or corporations have to concede that AI option isn't this, you know, one-for-one labor replacement.
But for now, it seems like capital investment in AI infrastructure is winning out over investment in human labor.
It is. And that takes us directly to the, well, the wild valuations of that AI infrastructure.
And why the ghost of the dot-com bubble is now haunting Wall Street.
Exactly. We're talking about The Big Short versus the AI juggernaut, and it's being led by Michael Burry.
The investor who saw the subprime mortgage meltdown coming.
The very same. And now he is publicly betting against the two giants of AI infrastructure, NVIDIA and Palantir.
Now, Burry is famously early, often too early, which is something he admits himself. But his thesis is provocative.
It is. He sees this current AI valuation boom as analogous not just to the housing bubble, but specifically to the data transmission bubble of the late 1990s.
Where companies with massive infrastructure but questionable short-term revenue were valued astronomically.
That's the one. And the scale of his position is where that Big Short element really comes in.
How big is it?
The upfront cost of his short bets, which he did through input options, was relatively small, around $10 million.
Which doesn't sound like a Big Short.
But the nature of options means it's a highly leveraged position. If those stocks move significantly in his favor, that $10 million initial outlay could translate into a payoff of over $1 billion.
So it's a low-cost, high-leverage move. He sees massive risk in the system and is positioning for a colossal sudden correction.
That's the narrative.
But why should we trust this Cassandra warning over the current market momentum? I mean, the market has largely shrugged off his call so far. The stocks haven't collapsed.
Well, we need to look at his specific critiques because they point to what he sees as structural weaknesses, not just market sentiment.
Okay, so take Palantir. What's his argument there?
Burry argues the company is too reliant on, in his words, stingy government contracts.
Right.
And that it's far too generous to its executives.
And what about competition?
That's the critical point. He highlights competition from behemoths like IBM, suggesting Palantir's specialized market niche is becoming rapidly commoditized.
So what's his price target?
He's predicting a drop to $50 a share by 2027.
Down from what, around $200?
Roughly, yeah. And Palantir's CEO, Alex Karp, his response was just to call Burry Batts crazy, which only adds to the drama.
It certainly does. And what about the NVIDIA position? That's maybe even more critical, given its enormous market cap.
His critique there targets two areas, accounting and financing. Burry alleges that the company's accounting practices, specifically around the assumed life expectancy of its chips, are helping to inflate earnings.
These are high-powered, rapidly obsolete chips.
Very. And the second claim, the more sensational one, is about the financing mechanism.
What's he alleging?
He alleges that NVIDIA is financing customer purchases, and he specifically names Oracle and Meta platforms in a way that financially supports the vendor purchasing its own products.
Which sounds a lot like...
He claims it resembles the financial maneuvers we saw at Enron, where the health of the business was artificially inflated by guaranteeing sales through financial support to the buyer.
Creating a self-sustaining circular financial relationship designed to boost reported revenue without reflecting genuine organic growth.
That's the allocation.
And NVIDIA, of course, has pushed back hard on this.
Oh, very hard. They released a memo stating that their underlying business is economically sound, their reporting is transparent, and that the comparison to historical frauds like Enron is unfounded. They argue that transparency makes the comparison irrelevant.
And for Burry's bet to pay off, what needs to happen to the stock?
NVIDIA needs to fall about 37% to hit $110 by 2027.
What's truly fascinating here is the psychological response. The fact that the call has had so little market impact suggests something weird is happening.
It does. For some investors, the awareness of this bubble anxiety actually encourages a belief that prices can just keep rising indefinitely.
It's a classic sign of market euphoria. The prophet warns of disaster, and the crowd just ignores the warning and dances harder.
That's right. And that anxiety about economic stability and long-term valuation brings us squarely to the Federal Reserve.
And the threat to its sacred independence.
Investors are now facing the reality of a potentially weak and divided Fed. President Trump has repeatedly demanded lower interest rates.
And he's made it clear he expects the next central bank chair to support his agenda, right? When Jerome Powell's term expires in May.
Exactly. And the markets have been relatively muted about this so far, but the underlying anxiety among serious investors is profound.
analysts are warning that a politically controlled, or maybe more accurately, a less independent Fed, poses an existential threat to long-term stability.
It removes the one entity that's intended to be insulated from political pressures. The one entity meant to act solely on economic data.
So to understand the threat, we need to look at the mechanism of control. How could this actually happen?
Well, monetary policy is set by the 12-member Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC. A president can't just set rates by decree.
Right.
However, if the president replaces Powell with a sympathetic chair and then successfully moves to remove a current governor.
Specifically Governor Elisa Cook.
Right. Whom the administration accuses of lying in mortgage paperwork, which is a charge she denies.
If those two things happen, the balance of power shifts.
Dramatically. Altering two key votes in what is often a closely divided body is enough to potentially swing the policy direction and increase volatility.
And the risk isn't just the political optics, it's the economic impact.
Absolutely. If a politically pressured Fed aggressively cuts rates while the underlying economy is still stable.
So cutting to satisfy political demands rather than inflationary data.
Right. If that happens, the market's faith in the Fed's management will just erode. The worry about persistent inflation could drive long-term treasury yields and borrowing costs up.
This is such a critical point. So short-term rates drop, but if investors fear the central bank has lost control of the long run, they demand higher yields on long-term bonds.
To compensate for the perceived inflationary risk, yes. And that simultaneous rise in long-term yields and drop in short-term rates, it rattles stocks and totally defeats the purpose of the political intervention.
And are we already seeing this reflected in the yield curve?
We are. The increasing gap between short-term and long-term treasury yields is a significant signal of investor anxiety.
It's like a homeowner. You might be happy to see a short-term drop in your variable loan rate, but if you see the 30-year fixed rate soaring because you lack confidence in the economy 5 years from now, you get deeply worried.
That's a perfect analogy. That gap signals that investors expect the short-term political cut, but they lack confidence in the long-term path. It's a clear pricing in of long-term monetary instability.
Okay, moving from the broad strokes of monetary policy and market structure, let's look at how political agendas are being executed domestically.
And often using powerful legal machinery in entirely new ways. This brings us to the Department of Justice's novel use of the False Claims Act, the FCA.
Against DEI initiatives.
Against diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, yes.
Okay, let's slow down on this because the mechanism is what really matters here. The False Claims Act is a serious piece of legislation.
It dates back to the Civil War, originally designed to prevent defense contractors from defrauding the Union Army.
Right. It allows the government to recover damages when federal funds are fraudulently obtained or spent.
And traditionally, it's used to go after, you know, defense contractors overbilling for spare parts or healthcare providers billing Medicaid for services that never happened.
But now, politically appointed officials within the Trump administration are leveraging it to target major U.S. companies.
Including Google and Verizon over their DEI practices.
And the legal theory here is highly aggressive, isn't it?
It's unconventional, for sure. The DOJ is arguing that companies that hold federal contracts, which nearly all major corporations do, and still use diversity as a factor in hiring, are essentially committing fraud against the government.
Their claim is that by adhering to DEI policies after a Trump executive order aimed at ending these preferences, the companies knowingly misrepresented their practices when they secured those contracts.
That's the theory. And the reason the FCA is so devastating is because of the concept of triple damages.
Right. It's not just about repaying the money. It's punitive.
Exactly. If the government proves fraud, the corporation has to pay three times the amount the government lost, plus civil penalties.
So for a company with billions in federal contracts, the liability is
catastrophic, potentially existential. Law firms specializing in this area note that the risk of these triple damages has rattled the corporate world far more than any regulatory fine ever could.
It forces an immediate, comprehensive reevaluation of all DEI policies.
It does. And this unconventional application of the FCA isn't just limited to corporate DEI.
Right. The sources indicate the DOJ is also using it to investigate doctors.
Doctors who are billing Medicaid for medical treatments for transgender youth that have been banned in certain states. They've sent out over 20 subpoenas to clinics and doctors already.
It shows the DOJ is using this powerful anti-fraud tool as a broad instrument for enforcing politically conservative policy objectives, dramatically increasing the risk for, well, for everyone.
It does. And that discussion of accountability and vulnerability, especially around medical procedures, leads us to a sector that desperately needs some kind of policy intervention.
You're talking about the multi-billion-dollar surrogacy industry.
I am. It highlights a really serious structural failure in regulation. Surrogacy is often framed emotionally, you know, as an intimate gift.
But the reality is that it's grown into a highly corporate, fragmented, and largely unregulated business.
And one that places immense financial and physical risk almost entirely on the surrogate, who is usually the party with fewer resources.
The case study of Nia Trent Wilson in Texas is just devastating.
It is. She had these complex medical complications, placenta accreta, during the delivery.
Which is a life-threatening condition.
It is, and it resulted in an emergency hysterectomy. She lost her uterus and fallopian tubes.
And the financial abandonment she experienced after that is just shocking.
Once the intended parents had their baby, they just stopped responding, stopped making payments to the escrow account meant to cover her medical expenses.
And she was left with over $182,000 in medical bills.
And in a chilling detail, the parents refused to pay the contracted fees, which were $44,800 total. And that included $10,000 specifically as compensation for the loss of her uterus.
Unbelievable. Her subsequent lawsuit against the agency, ACRC Global, revealed the lopsided nature of these contracts.
Yes, and a California judge reviewed the agreement and made a very powerful finding.
The judge ruled the agency's liability cap of just $4,000 was unenforceable.
Right. The judge argued that the agreement essentially used the surrogate's body for a profit venturing business while placing tremendous risk on the surrogate and, quote, a no-risk obligation on the corporate agency.
That ruling perfectly encapsulates the issue here.
It does. This is an industry where private equity firms like Corteca's and major fertility clinics like Kindbody are aggressively entering the market,
trying to create these one-stop shops for profit.
And when corporate money enters a highly intimate, high-risk biological process without uniform regulation, you create these dangerous financial sinkholes for the women involved.
The urgency for New York State-style comprehensive regulation is clear when you see the level of financial devastation this can inflict.
Absolutely. Now let's pivot from these intensely personal financial risks to the enormous scale of public spending.
And specifically examining the soaring cost and the questionable efficiency of Obamacare subsidies.
A new study published in the JAMA Health Forum suggests that extending the current enhanced premium subsidies is financially unsustainable and, well, reckless toward the taxpayer.
The numbers are dramatically different from when the program started.
They are staggering. Taxpayers paid nearly 80% of subsidized premiums in 2024.
80%. Compared to what back in 2014?
Just 30% in 2014. The total taxpayer bill for these subsidies alone was over $114 billion in 2024.
And the problem is structural. It's the subsidy design itself.
Yes. The design insulates enrollees from rising premium costs. The system is set up so that the enrollee only pays a premium that equals a set percentage of their income for a benchmark plan.
So if the premium for that plan soars, which they have,
the federal subsidy automatically covers the difference. The enrollee never feels the increase, but the taxpayer absorbs 100% of that premium inflation.
It's a perverse incentive structure. It encourages higher enrollment and critically fraudulent applications.
And the Government Accountability Office confirmed that vulnerability to fraud. They approved 23 out of 24 fictitious applications in a test run.
And 18 of those fake enrollments were still covered a year later.
Right. Furthermore, the study argues that this generous subsidy regime is actively undermining the private market by crowding out employer-sponsored insurance.
So people who might have stayed on their company plans are now lured into the federal subsidized Obamacare plans,
shrinking the market for unsubsidized plans by a quarter since 2014. The system is just structurally dependent on massive, growing taxpayer funding.
And contrasting this immense burden, you have the legislative wins being touted by House Republicans.
Right, particularly focusing on tax relief and deregulation. They point to the Working Families Tax Cuts Package, signed last July.
This is framed as a significant financial boon for the average American family.
It is. House Speaker Mike Johnson projected that the bill would lead to an average $10,000 increase in take-home pay.
And a tax refund of $1,000 to $2,000 hitting bank accounts this spring.
That's the promise. This is the positive side of legislative action, direct relief aimed at the middle class.
Beyond tax cuts, the sources highlight the massive financial benefit from targeted deregulation.
Yes, the Trump administration's decision to remove specific Biden-era mandates on broadband projects.
Mandates about union consultation, mandatory affordability plans, things like that.
Right. And removing them is projected to save taxpayers $21 billion across various projects.
The difference in cost is stunning. The Louisiana broadband project is the perfect example.
It is. Under the old rules, the project was costing $120,000 per connection.
$120,000.
After the deregulation, which removed layers of red tape, the cost dropped to $7,547 per connection.
That demonstrates how regulatory overhead can inflate public spending by orders of magnitude.
Absolutely. And that immense domestic cost and structural friction is set against a global stage where tectonic plates are shifting.
Which transitions us to the fundamental reassessment of transatlantic policy, which the Trump administration has framed as an attack on the EU.
And this isn't just a minor diplomatic spat. This is the potential dissolution of the strategic alliance that has defined the post-World War II global order.
Administration officials are now targeting the European Union as their principal challenge.
Fundamentally upending decades of bipartisan U.S. policy. The official critique is blistering.
They view the EU as an overregulated bureaucracy, criticizing it for being too weak on defense spending and immigration.
And there's the charged accusation that the EU is actively squelching national character among its member states.
And Vice President Vance's use of the term commissars to describe EU officials.
That word, historically associated with the Soviet Union, shows the depth of the strategic divergence.
This political friction then spills directly into trade conflict.
Of course. The U.S. Trade Representative has threatened retaliatory tariffs if the EU continues to impose large fines on American tech giants.
Like the $140 million penalty against the social media platform X.
Exactly. Washington is positioning itself as the defender of U.S. tech interests, regardless of the EU's attempts to enforce its own digital sovereignty.
And European officials are not taking this lying down.
No, they reject the U.S. criticism as driven purely by American commercial self-interest, an attempt to protect Silicon Valley.
They argue the EU is a necessary defender of European sovereignty and the only way they have to jumpstart their lagging economy.
And this divergence creates deep instability, as the two largest democratic economic blocs are now working at cross purposes.
This political fracturing is happening just as the physical mechanisms of globalization are also fracturing.
And we see this in the astonishing journey of the Zhenhua 29 cargo ship.
A stunning example of logistical absurdity that signals peak globalization might be behind us.
This ship undertook a 19,687 nautical mile, 3.5-month marathon voyage from Shanghai to the U.S. Gulf Coast.
Delivering 5 massive Chinese ship-to-shore cranes.
And here's the key detail, the profound insight. The ship took the long way around, circumnavigating Africa.
Why?
Because the cranes themselves, with their enormous outstretched booms reaching over 200 feet, were simply too tall to safely fit through the locks of the Panama Canal.
Which is a fast route.
The fast route takes about a month. This journey took over 14 weeks.
The logistics must have been punishing.
They were. The ship had to stop for weeks off Mozambique in South Africa, just waiting for 12-foot seas to subside so it could navigate around the Cape.
It underscores the fragility of global logistics when the very tools needed for global trade are too large for the traditional shortcuts.
But this journey is not just a lesson in marine engineering. It's a national security issue.
Because these are Chinese-made cranes.
Right. They account for about 80% of those at U.S. ports. The administration views China's control over the manufacturing and the remote control tech installed in the cranes as a significant vulnerability.
There's a real fear China could use this tech to spy on U.S. ports or, in a conflict, remotely shut them down.
A very real fear. The U.S. is now encouraging port operators to buy cranes elsewhere. But for now, the path of least resistance still involves China.
And the distrust is palpable. It reaches a shocking human level.
You mean with the crew?
Yes. The crew of the Zhenhua 29, after nearly 3 months at sea, were not allowed to disembark in Gulfport, Mississippi for security reasons.
So the physical shipment of goods is now intertwined with such profound security paranoia that even the crew delivering the goods is seen as a risk.
Exactly. Shifting focus now to global hotspots, we see a complex dynamic of persistent conflict and strange diplomatic alignments.
In Ukraine, the push for a negotiated end to the war continues, but with tremendous friction.
Right. President Trump and Ukrainian President Zelensky met to review a 20-point draft proposal.
And this revised plan is a significant shift from earlier versions that were criticized for being too favorable to Moscow.
What's in the new proposal?
It calls for a national referendum in Ukraine on potential territorial concessions and the scheduling of presidential elections. The U.S. is floating the idea of a demilitarized, free economic zone in the Donbas.
And Zelensky has indicated a willingness to consider that zone, but only if Russia withdraws its forces from Donetsk.
Right. But despite this cautious optimism, Russia continues to reject a formal ceasefire and is relentlessly pushing for full control of the region.
Meanwhile, Russia's strategy in Ukraine remains devastatingly methodical.
They're focused on breaking the logistical backbone of the Ukrainian economy. The state railway company reports over 1,100 targeted attacks on its infrastructure this year,
hitting everything from control towers and depots to substations.
It's a deliberate, structured campaign that's inflicted $5.8 billion in damages. The human cost is seen in railway drivers having to wear helmets while operating in high-risk zones.
Elsewhere in Myanmar, we see a stunning diplomatic pivot.
The military junta held parliamentary elections, which international organizations and Western governments immediately condemned as a sham.
Right, the military controls less than half the country and banned the opposition party that won the 2020 election.
Yet in a stark contrast to traditional U.S. policy, the Trump administration joined both China and Russia in backing the poll,
which signals a significant shift in diplomatic priorities and a clear deprioritization of promoting democracy abroad.
A huge one. Moving to regional conflicts, Thailand and Cambodia signed a ceasefire
to halt 3 weeks of deadly fighting along their disputed 500-mile border.
This conflict has been the deadliest on record, involving heavy artillery and airstrikes, and displacing over 700,000 people. And the truce is fragile. An earlier one already collapsed.
In the Middle East, the rhetoric is escalating dramatically.
Ahead of a meeting between President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu, Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian delivered a searing statement.
He declared that Iran is in a full-scale war with the U.S., Israel, and Europe,
characterizing the current conflict as worse than the deadly years-long war with Iraq in the 1980s. That is a profound statement of perceived existential threat from Tehran.
And finally, a note on political consolidation in Argentina.
President Javier Milei successfully passed his first budget in 2 years.
A crucial victory that signals he is mastering the art of political compromise, something many analysts doubted he could do.
This budget is vital. It shores up financial backing from the IMF, supporting his radical austerity agenda.
And he achieved this despite making key concessions, notably allowing funding for university education and disability payments.
His next big domestic challenge will be overhauling the country's rigid labor laws, which have long discouraged hiring.
Okay, transitioning now from the geopolitical arena to innovations affecting human health.
We arrive at a topic of enormous interest to millions: chronic pain management. We have major new clinical trial data on using cannabis as an alternative treatment.
This is huge. Chronic lower back pain affects over 70 million U.S. adults. It's the single leading cause of disability worldwide.
And the scarcity of safe, effective, non-addictive treatments has led many to opioids or to seeking out alternative therapies, often without rigorous data to back it up.
But this new data provides exactly that rigor.
It comes from two large phase 3 clinical trials from a German pharmaceutical company. They tested a proprietary THC-based cannabis extract,
formulated to include other cannabinoids like CBD and CBG.
Yes. And the key finding, the extract was not only safe, but significantly more effective at reducing chronic lower back pain than both a placebo and the opioid control group.
And the most compelling finding from a public health perspective is the stability of the dosing.
Absolutely. Unlike the opioid group, which often required dosage increases over time, the cannabis patients did not need to increase their dosage during the long-term study.
So after an initial period to find the right amount, their dose was stabilized,
which suggests a far lower risk of dependence compared to traditional pain management.
Now, the specific product is expected in Europe next year, but it still needs another trial for U.S. FDA approval.
Right. But the data has immediate implications for U.S. medical practice. Physicians may become more comfortable prescribing FDA-approved synthetic THC, like dronabinol, off-label for back pain now that they have this evidence base.
This pursuit of safer, more precise treatments is also driving innovation in other complex areas.
It is, leading sophisticated cancer treatments toward autoimmune diseases. We are talking about antibody drug conjugates, or ADCs.
The guided missile of cancer therapy.
Exactly. They combine an antibody, which is the targeting mechanism, with a potent drug payload. The antibody finds the cancer cell, the drug is delivered directly, minimizing harm to healthy tissue.
And now, companies like Lyfforti Immunotherapeutics are adapting this approach for autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis.
RA affects millions, and while treatments exist, they often come with severe systemic side effects.
So what's Lyfforti's strategy?
It's brilliant. They're combining an antibody with fast-acting anti-inflammatories known as glucocorticoids, common steroids.
But those steroids carry serious systemic side effects, like bone density loss leading to osteoporosis.
Right. But by using the ADC, the antibody specifically steers the glucocorticoids to the target immune cells. The highly localized delivery maximizes the effect where it's needed and minimizes systemic exposure.
Thus, significantly reducing side effects like osteoporosis.
That's the goal. But the commercialization hurdle here is fascinating. Cancer ADCs are usually given via slow IV infusion in a clinic.
And for RA patients who need chronic treatment, that's not viable.
Exactly. The ADC has to be formulated for subcutaneous self-injection so they can administer it at home. The 40 is heavily focused on meeting that delivery requirement.
So the technology may be brilliant, but convenience dictates commercial success.
It does. It's a market that values specialized skills and precise execution.
Which brings us, unexpectedly, to the boom in specialized vocational training and the specialized art of the auctioneer.
The rise of vocational high schools in Massachusetts is a major cultural signal. They were long seen as the track for academic underperformers.
And now enrollment has grown by 25% in a decade, with huge waiting lists. Why the sudden cachet?
Because they provide the ultimate hedge against the AI-driven white-collar stagnation we just talked about.
While data analysts face disruption, the specialized trades plumbing HVAC auto collision require complex, high-touch, non-substitutable human skills.
Parents recognize that specialized training provides a tangible competitive advantage.
And most of these graduates, two-thirds of them, still go on to college.
They use the vocational training not as a terminal degree, but as a strong foundation, knowing they have a valuable recession-proof trade to fall back on. The student quote says it all. Any direction you want to go, your options are open.
That is the new definition of security in the labor market.
It is. And speaking of non-substitutable human performance, let's talk about the unique skill of the auctioneer.
Trained at places like the Western College of Auctioneering.
The bid call is described as an art form that demands absolute control over cadence, pitch, projection, and body language.
They teach students to use techniques like keeping their palms up, to invite bids in an open, non-aggressive way.
And they train them to master the high-speed patter known as the cattle rattle, that brisk, train-like tempo that creates energy and urgency.
It's an adrenalized, specialized performance requiring an emotional engagement that AI just cannot replicate. The instructor's advice, just let go, don't be so tense, belies the tremendous discipline required.
It's a uniquely human market performance.
Okay, let's explore the tension between convenience and surveillance that defines our modern culture.
Particularly through the lens of drones in routine police enforcement.
Drones are rapidly moving beyond specialized SWAT operations and are becoming a standard part of the police toolkit. At least 6,000 programs are operating nationwide.
And they're being deployed as first responders, trailing suspects, and increasingly, enforcing local ordinances to generate revenue.
And this revenue generation is where the conflict with civil liberties becomes really intense.
It is. Police in towns outside Pittsburgh use drones to record motorists rolling through stop signs, issuing fines that bolster city coffers.
In a Northern California city, drones hovering 400 feet in the air detected illegal fireworks, leading to over $300,000 in fines.
The fact that law enforcement is relying on pervasive air surveillance for routine revenue generation, it shifts the fundamental relationship between the police and the public.
Civil liberty groups are sounding the alarm, warning that patrolling drones without warrants verge on harassment and fundamentally change what it's like to be out in public in America.
The concern is that pervasive aerial surveillance chills free expression and privacy. Police departments try to mitigate this by maintaining transparency, making flight records public, and adhering to protocols.
But those protocols offer little comfort when the core application is generating traffic fine revenue.
Right. And shifting from public surveillance to intensely private matters, we see a fascinating cultural movement toward the destigmatization of ailments.
Often achieved through branding and social media authenticity, it's the cool makeover trend.
New consumer brands are taking traditionally embarrassing products, like hemorrhoid cream, and rebranding them, using levity and authenticity to build genuine community.
Take the brand norms. They sell hemorrhoid cream, wipes, and even merchandise with 70s-style graphics and humor. They're directly positioning themselves against brands like Preparation H.
This cultural shift is driven by younger consumers who demand authenticity, often using social media to provide educational content. Norms has Hemi's 101 videos on topics like proper wiping.
It brings the discussion into the light, removing the shame associated with, you know, 1980s pharmacy aisles.
And the irony here is profound. It speaks to the hidden costs of our convenience culture.
One major lifestyle factor cited as contributing to the increased prevalence of hemorrhoids is prolonged sitting on the toilet due specifically to cell phone use.
So the technology that delivers convenience and constant connectivity is directly contributing to a physical ailment.
Which is then managed by new brands using that very same technology, social media, to normalize the condition. It's a perfect circular critique of modern life.
Speaking of convenience, let's look at how it influences travel and commerce.
We are seeing increasing traveler loyalty to small regional airports.
People are actively trading the convenience of a direct flight from a major hub for the sheer convenience of a smaller operation. The value proposition is simple: cheap parking, short walks, and minimal TSA waits.
It's a quality of life calculation. A corporate attorney in Wichita noted that saving $100 on a ticket isn't worth a three-hour drive home. Convenience is outweighing the perceived value of a nonstop route.
On the commerce front, we have a clear breakdown of accountability at the high-end retail giant Saks.
The company failed spectacularly to follow up on customer complaints about suspicious charges long before a top stylist was accused of $400,000 in fraud.
This is a powerful anecdote about corporate oversight failure. One client claims he raised very clear red flags about charges that eventually spiraled into hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And he got no response from store management, even after emailing the CEO of Saks Global.
While the stylist spokesperson called the client an out-of-control impulse shopper, the core issue remains. If repeated high-value complaints are ignored, it suggests a profound lapse in corporate security and customer service follow-up.
Which allows fraud to fester for months, if not years.
Okay, stepping back and synthesizing this entire deep dive, we see two massive defining tensions running through all these sources.
They really explain the current turbulence. The first tension is this radical divergence between high-risk investment and hyper-conservative cost-saving.
Exactly. Wall Street is betting billions on the exponential rise of AI infrastructure, even as skeptics like Michael Burry warn of historic bubbles.
Yet, corporations are simultaneously locking down their white-collar hiring because they fear volatility or, more likely, because they are structurally reducing their need for human labor.
It's a world where capital is flowing into massive, future-oriented risk while labor is paralyzed by present-day caution.
And the second tension is the dramatic gap between political goals and the messy, often damaging reality of execution.
On one hand, a policy is executed through unconventional legal warfare, using the False Claims Act to successfully rattle the corporate world over DEI.
And on the other, you have a multi-billion dollar high-risk industry like surrogacy, where policy has failed entirely, leaving vulnerable women financially and physically exposed.
It brings us back to the persistent rise of technology. Andy Kessler's opinion piece highlighted two concepts: asymptotic growth technology growing toward infinity, and assimilative, where tech becomes invisible, like electricity.
That assimilative nature is what makes the long-term costs so difficult to see and to price in. AI is becoming electricity. Screens are simply how we live.
But what happens when that relentless, asymptotic rise in screen reliance begins to incur asymptomatic physical costs?
The health section contained that powerful opinion piece highlighting the childhood epidemic of myopia and nearsightedness.
Caused by excessive screen time and indoor life, the eye physically elongates from focusing too much up close. China is treating this as a national security threat and banning screens for toddlers.
So the provocative thought we leave you with is this: if technology assimilation continues its exponential rise and the symptoms of long-term physical or social harm, like the myopia epidemic or the lifestyle shift leading to other ailments, are slow to appear,
what irreversible costs are being accumulated asymptomatically by the next generation, far beyond the financial bubbles and political skirmishes we can currently spot?
The long-term, unseen price of convenience and connectivity is the real deep dive for the future.
We've covered a tremendous amount of ground today, from Michael Burry's leveraged short bets to the long, slow, geopolitically fraught voyage of a Chinese crane around Africa. We hope this deep dive has provided you with clarity and actionable insights.
Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more critical analysis for the well-informed learner.
Until next time.